All right, we'll go ahead and get started. It is a quarter till. Thank you all for coming, for breaking away from the cookies to come to this session, and thanks to anybody who's watching online. My name is Tom Cavanaugh. I am the Associate Vice President of Distributed Learning at the University of Central Florida in Orlando. And the title of the discussion today is The Postmodality Era, How Online Learning is Becoming Learning. So let's start with a question. This is probably an easy question. On the left, actually, these are both real students that I made up. So they are sort of prototypical, archetypical kinds of students. But on the left is Carol. And Carol is a nurse who works odd shifts. She sometimes works a graveyard shift, sometimes works different days of the week, and has trouble fitting in regular face-to-face class meetings to further her education. On the right is Jared. Jared looks very happy to be in his 8 o'clock freshman composition class. And he is a regular 18 to 24-year-old student demographic going to class, living in the dorms, participating in intramural athletics, and pledging a fraternity. So when we think of e-learning and we think of distance learning, who jumps out as probably the more likely e-learner? Carol, yes. And that is typically what we see. Carol is a non-traditional student. She's an adult. She's working full-time. Jared is a traditional student who is engaging with the on-campus experience. However, what we find, and what we'll be talking about today, is the blurring of these boundaries between the traditional student and the non-traditional student, where traditional students increasingly are needing non-traditional flexibility. And we'll define kind of what that means as we go along. So the idea of the traditional student is kind of disappearing in many places. We'll go over some statistics on the next slide. But they increasingly need this non-traditional flexibility because of things that they are doing. Many of them work. Many of them work full-time or at least part-time. They maybe participate in campus activities such as Greek life or athletics, intramural athletics or intercollegiate athletics, other co-curricular activities, dance or clubs or other kinds of affinity groups. And what we have found at the University of Central Florida, kind of counterintuitively, is that the use of online learning, the choice of having online learning options, allows a student to more actively engage in the on-campus experience because it affords them schedule flexibility. They can participate in these face-to-face on-campus activities because they're taking classes online. We'll talk about some numbers there. So when we look at the growth of online, I have not updated this with the recent Babson report that just came out, but these are last year's numbers, and the story is sort of the same. So in 2010, over 6.1 million students took at least one online course, which was an increase of over 500,000 students nationwide over the previous year. That 10% growth for online enrollments far exceeds the 2% growth in overall higher ed student growth. 31% of higher education students now take at least one course online during an academic year. And 65% of higher education institutions say that online learning is a critical part of their long-term strategy. Those are the presidents talking. And that's coming from the Sloan Consortium and the Babson study from last year. There's a brand new one that just came out that says very similar things. So when we talk about these blurring boundaries between traditional and non-traditional, of the 17.5 million undergraduates currently enrolled in higher education today, only 15% attend a four-year institution and live on campus. 37% are enrolled part-time, and 32% of those students work full-time. So the idea of the traditional student, the 18-year-old who graduates high school and goes off to college for 4 years, is the minority now when you're looking at even the four-year campus experience. And only 36% of students who are enrolled in, quote, four-year institutions actually graduate in 4 years. The more common metric now is the six-year graduation rate. And even that sometimes doesn't capture the whole story because it sometimes takes students longer than 6 years to graduate. The Sloan Consortium, which is the big online learning organization, had a couple years ago a program called Localness. Have any of you ever heard of that? Familiar with localness? Localness is this concept that no matter where a student is, their education is local to them. Whether it's face-to-face on the main campus, face-to-face at a regional campus that might be in their backyard, online, or maybe through blended learning. That they have these options that they can choose from so that all of their education becomes accessible to them in the most convenient way possible, making it thus sort of local. That's sort of one overarching definition of this concept, localness. So in that kind of a context, classifying a student as a main campus student or an extended campus student or a regional campus student or an online student or a distance student becomes completely meaningless when these students are sort of swirling through all of these locations and all of these modalities at any given point in their academic career or even in a semester. And I'll share some case studies on how that's actually manifesting. And you can't really track these students as these distinct categories. So they're kind of unconcerned with these categorical labels. They're really concerned about getting the courses they want, when they want them, in the manner that's most convenient to them. And they're really not cared if they're called a regional student or a main campus student or an online student or a face-to-face student. My colleagues at UCF, Chuck Jubin and Patsy Moskal, published an article in which they talk about this phenomenon a little bit, and it's called A Course is a Course. And in this article, they talk about how students were able to translate the end-of-course survey, which was written mostly for a face-to-face environment. But the online students were able to translate the sort of face-to-face-ish questions to an online context with no trouble at all. They're not even thinking in these terms when it comes to evaluating their courses. So to them, a course is a course, no matter how it's offered. So let's talk about blended learning very briefly, just to sort of get us all on the same page. And I'll start from the bottom up. You can blend in a variety of ways. You can blend at the assignment level. So say you're not reducing the seat time of a course. You're more enhancing a regular face-to-face course with online components. That could be a blend at the assignment level. At the course level, which is what we mostly think of when we're thinking of blended learning, where you have maybe half the course is taught online and half the course is taught face-to-face, so that Tuesday-Thursday block can be used by two courses and the balance is done online. That's sort of at the course level, and that's kind of at the modality level. At the program level, which is what I'm going to mostly talk about today, is this idea of localness, where a student can blend their educational path by choosing some face-to-face courses, some online courses, and some blended courses, mostly based upon their own needs and their own desires at that time, as opposed to an institutional pathway that's prescribed for them. Further kind of reinforcing this behavior is our system pressures that are coming from outside of the institution as well. So when on one side you've got student preferences, where students just want to take what they want to take based on their own convenience. You also have these demands to be more efficient, whether it's cost or throughput, at the policy state policymaker levels. So you look at things such as University System of Maryland requiring undergraduates to complete 12 credits in alternative learning modes, one of which is online learning. Texas, in the past, I don't think this has actually come to fruition, but in the past proposed a similar rule with the 10% threshold being delivered by alternative means. And when Tim Pawlenty was governor of Minnesota, he proposed that 25% of all students, all student credits be earned through online learning, and he had put out a 2015 deadline for that to happen. All of these things are sort of coalescing where you've got these top-down pressures coming from systems being pushed into institutions, and student pressures coming up from above or from below saying, this is how I want to take my courses, creates a very interesting dynamic that is fueling the growth of this sort of behavior. So I'm going to highlight four different institutions. They're all, to varying degrees, examples of this sort of course-taking behavior, but they're all very different institutions. So maybe you'll find something that's like you in these examples. And I'll start with my own institution at UCF. If you're not familiar with UCF, we're a metropolitan suburban university in East Orlando. We're now the second largest university in the country, 60,000 students last fall. We're a very high research R1, 216 degree programs across 11 different colleges, including a new medical school, and 11 campuses through the regional campus network. And I'll talk more about the regional campus network in a minute. When we look at online learning at UCF, the blue area at the bottom represents face-to-face classroom instruction, sort of the traditional face-to-face instruction. That kind of greenish thing in the middle represents video. Various video modalities over the years have been sort of aggregated into that, but most recently, lecture capture video. And the red are online asynchronous modalities, including fully online web-based and blended learning. And I'll split that in half on the next slide. But you can see what's happening. As state support has waned and as growth has outpaced our ability to keep students in face-to-face seats, we're unable to have the physical infrastructure of the campus keep up with demand. And we have an access mission to try and provide education to as many students who want a UCF education as possible. If it were not for online learning, we wouldn't have 60,000 students. But as you'll see, the way they mix and match between these modalities is very idiosyncratic. It's totally unique to each individual student. So that red area is split like this, with the blue line on top representing the fully online courses, and the greenish line are blended learning courses. And our growth rate has exceeded that even of those Sloan-Babson numbers I gave at the start of the presentation. Okay, let's get in our time machine. Let's go back to the fall of 2008, and I will deconstruct this fairly strange-looking Venn diagram. The yellow area represents face-to-face instruction, traditional face-to-face instruction, on the main campus in Orlando. The reddish area towards the bottom are our 10 regional campuses around our 11-county service area. The green circle at the top represents a separate campus that we have down by the attractions in Orlando, our hospitality campus. If you haven't been there, it's like a resort. You should go visit it. It's fabulous. And the blue circle are web students. So you can see how this is all kind of broken up. I'm going to step over here. I'm going to highlight this circle, or this intersecting kind of quadrant here. So in fall of 2008, we had 363 students who took face-to-face course on the main campus, face-to-face course on a regional campus, say like Cocoa Beach or Daytona, and online course, all at the same time in the same semester. That's localness, where they're kind of doing what they need to do when they need to do it. And so in 2008, 33,000 face-to-face students represented almost 66% of the UCF headcount. Web students, 11,500. Let's fast forward a year. We see we've gone down to 63.5% of the total population in face-to-face. We've gone up 3,000 students on the web. Another year forward, we're down to 60% face-to-face, yet the total number is actually higher. We keep going up in the face-to-face, but the percentage is dropping because the web-based instruction keeps going up by about 3,000 students a year. So it's outpacing the growth in the face-to-face environment, which you could see in that area chart. The blue was starting to level off. And then the most recent data that we have, now we're under 60% face-to-face, and we're at 18,500 students who are taking online courses. The blended courses live in this yellow circle because they have a face-to-face component to them. And now we're up to 500 students in this little quadrant who are taking regional campus, main campus, face-to-face, and online at the same time. So let's look at just the regional campuses as a bit of an exemplar on this post-modality sort of behavior. If you look at the growth of student credit hour production on the regional campuses going back to 2005, The blue line at the bottom, the blue stack, the dark blue stack, represents face-to-face instruction. The light blue is fully online web, video lecture capture, and then, blended learning, and then the top stack is video lecture capture. And you can see what's happened. The face-to-face instruction has remained basically flat over those years. In some cases, it's grown a little bit. So the growth of the regional campuses hasn't been at the expense of face-to-face instruction. But blended and online learning has really fueled the growth on the regional campuses and provided those non-traditional students, the Carols of the world, the ability to access education locally for them. And what this means in numbers is that, I'll just highlight the very bottom. Fully online represents 60% of the regional campuses. Blended represents 7% when we're talking about student credit hours. And face-to-face is only about 26% of the regional campuses' student credit hours at this point. All right, let's take a step back, look at the entire university. In fall 2010, we can slice and dice the course-taking behaviors of our students depending upon how we want to filter it. Web or blended, face-to-face plus web, face-to-face plus blended. Let me just highlight the second to last row. Face-to-face, web, and blended. We had about 2,700 students, and this is pretty consistent, I think, in fall of 2011 as well, who took face-to-face courses, web-based courses, and blended courses, all at the same time in the same semester in 2010, fall of 2010. Our localness grant that we got from the Sloan Consortium, there were a number of schools that got these localness grants. We created something called Learning on Demand, and this was the website for it. And really what this does is promote post-modality course-taking behaviors. It says, choose the modality that best fits you at this time in your academic career, and pick and choose whatever makes the most sense, whether it's in-class, web, mixed mode, which is our blended format, and media enhanced, which is face-to-face with web enhancements. Okay, let me move on to a completely different kind of institution, which is a former employer of mine, so I know it well. Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. How many of you have ever heard of Embry-Riddle? Oh, good, a few. Most people either know it well or have no idea. I've never heard of it. Embry-Riddle is really known for its aeronautical education. With aviation, they do a lot of flight training. They've got probably what they call their flagship campus. When I worked at the worldwide campus, we weren't supposed to call it the main campus. I don't work there anymore, so maybe I can say that. But there's the Daytona campus, the Prescott campus, which is out in Prescott, Arizona. Am I pronouncing that right? Anybody from Arizona? I'm told it's Prescott, not Prescott. So Prescott. And then the worldwide campus, which is a network of teaching sites across the world, literally, most of them affiliated with military bases, and online learning. It has this aviation aerospace focus, and as I mentioned, this worldwide campus, they're up to about 150 teaching locations throughout the world. They have a number of modalities that they define as well, similar to UCS modalities. Face-to-face classroom learning, and I'm just going to talk mostly about the worldwide campus now, because that's where my data are from. Eagle Vision Classroom, which is their synchronous web video conferencing system. Eagle Vision Home, which is synchronous web video conferencing, but where the student accesses it from home. It doesn't come to a classroom somewhere. Online learning, which is a completely online asynchronous that we're all very familiar with, and blended, which is exactly what we're doing at UCF. But in some cases, I actually taught a blended course for Embry-Riddle one time and used blended learning not so much to better utilize space, but pedagogically because it was a long block. It was a five-hour block once a week after work. And I blended the course sort of to reduce fatigue for both me and the students because it was a long night. And so if we look at their data and the growth in certain modalities and how their students take courses, you can see that they're mixing and matching different modalities depending upon what they need at that time as well. They have a highly mobile student population, a lot of military students, a lot of pilots, people who are always going around to different places as part of their jobs or for periods of time. So the idea of having this kind of post-modality flexibility is really critical for their students to, for retention of their students in these programs. And you see where the largest growth is, in blended, Eagle Vision, and most notably Eagle Vision Home, this synchronous online modality that's delivered to students where they can stay at home, grew 90% from 09-10 to 10-11. And then the traditional online learning is sort of the juggernaut of the worldwide organization. So these are duplicated headcount. And you can see that students are mixing and matching and taking multiple modalities at the same time. And they'll move from location to location if they need to. If they're taking courses at the Huntsville site, and then they get deployed, well, next thing you know, they might be taking online classes and courses in you know, Bagram in Afghanistan or something. And I took this quote from their website, which really sums up the same thing that the Learning on Demand page at UCF's localness grant did, where it says, the goal is to give you exactly the education you need, exactly the way you need it, offering more ways to take courses, same high-quality information, instruction, and opportunities. Simply pick the one that fits your learning and lifestyle best. So they're putting all of this choice and flexibility in the hands of the students. And we'll see that as a theme and through all four of these organizations. The next one is University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. They are an urban state university, 31,000 students, a large school, with 14 different schools and colleges, 180 degree programs, and like UCF, also what was an R1, very high research activity. And if we look at their data, and again, these show how students are mixing and matching. These are sort of duplicated numbers, so there's overlap between these. I've highlighted some of the ones that are kind of interesting for growth. The number of students taking at least one online course, 7,000 students that are taking at least one online course out of their 31,000 students. Number of students taking exclusively online courses. So you can see the delta between there. Most of the students who are taking online courses are also taking face-to-face courses. Number of students taking blended or online is over 8,000. Number of students taking a combination of face-to-face and fully online is 5,600. So similar to the phenomenon that we experienced at UCF, where the students are taking all these different modalities at different times and in different ways. Or at the same time. And so I pulled a quote off of their website from Milwaukee. They offer the opportunity to take both online and on-campus courses and programs. It's your option. You can take a combination of both online and in-person courses, and they also promote blended courses as part of their offerings. Rio Salado. Most of you are probably familiar with Rio Salado. They get mentioned a lot at these kinds of conferences. They do some really interesting work. Part of the Maricopa Community College System, founded in 78 as a, quote, college without walls. They are particularly known for their innovations in online learning. But they also have 16 physical locations around Arizona, Tempe. And they also have a particular outreach for incarcerated students. Their data look like this. And I'll highlight that 2000 number at the bottom. So they've got about the same number of students as UCF does. I don't think theirs are all full-time, kind of like UCF's, most of ours are. But they have about the same number of students who are taking these multiple modalities as we do. So if you look at UCF, we had 2,700 students, if you remember, that took face-to-face, online, and blended at the same time. Rio Salado has 2,000 that are doing essentially the same thing. But the interesting thing is most of their students are online. And what they're doing now is trying to supplement their online education with face-to-face courses. So they're coming at it from the opposite angle of what UCF students are doing. But it's the same behavior in reverse, where they want this kind of flexibility. They occasionally want face-to-face interaction. And their ethos that they advertise on their website is choice, access, and flexibility, customized high-quality learning design, and personalized service and organizational responsiveness. Okay, so let's take one step back and look at how this plays in the K-12 world, because these K-12 students are the next ones that are going to come into this ecosystem, if you will, of post-modality behaviors. So I pulled some stats from INECAL. INECAL is the international, I forget the exact acronym, but it's the online learning organization for K-12 students. It's a fantastic group and has a lot of great resources. And they have more stats than this, and I don't want to overwhelm you with statistics, but some of these I thought were pretty interesting. 48 states plus DC offer supplemental or full-time online learning opportunities for K-12 students. 75% of K-12 districts had one or more students enrolled in an online or blended learning course. 75% across the country. In 2010, over 4 million K-12 students participated in a formal online learning program, and that includes 217,000 students in cyber charter schools. Online learning enrollments are growing by 46% a year, and that growth rate is accelerating. That's a pretty high growth rate. So, how's that manifesting on the ground? Well, think again about the top-down system pressures I talked about in the higher ed environment. In the K-12 environment, the same thing is happening. So in a couple of states, in Michigan and Alabama and in my state of Florida, their departments of education have mandated that you need to have at least one online course on your transcript for you to graduate from high school. From a public high school. Idaho had proposed two, and I think that had been challenged in the courts, and I think that may not be a requirement anymore, but at one point it was. Every district in the state of Florida, there are 67 different K-12 school districts, must by state law offer a full K-12 option for all the students in their district. And more than 115,000 students took at least one online course from the Florida Virtual School, which I think is arguably the largest K-12 virtual school in the country. So the question for all of us in higher education is, how are we going to respond when these students who've become accustomed to blending their learning experiences between face-to-face and online technologies come to our doors and matriculate into our institutions? Are we going to be prepared for them and their expectations? So, of course, I have some completely unsolicited advice for all of us on what we can do to prepare. We need to expand campus information systems to make it easier for students to select and register for online and blended offerings. And perhaps even as a prerequisite for that, define what these modalities mean for us. One of the great advantages that all of the institutions that I highlighted here have is that they have consistent vocabulary within their institutions of what these modalities are, what they mean, and they can track them. And so we need the information systems that allow that. Reconfiguring academic support services, including advising and library assistance to address online asynchronous learners. They need to be able to access all of the same resources that the face-to-face students have access to. Whether that's business systems, whether that's library resources, whether that's advising, all of that needs to be available to them so that they can take advantage of it if they're taking an online course or a face-to-face course. We have a saying at UCF, online, not inline. So all of the infrastructure that we've put in place to support our online students is available to our face-to-face students. And we don't see lines at the registrar's office anymore because everybody's doing things online, even the face-to-face students. Add multimedia and network capability to on-campus classrooms to kind of help bridge that connection between online and on-ground environments for students who are moving seamlessly between the two. So a student who's taking a face-to-face, a blended, and an online course all at the same time will expect to come into a face-to-face classroom that has some technology integrated with it. Expand campus technology infrastructure to accommodate students who are doing online coursework not only at a distance, but online in the campus, in the on-campus environment, whether they're accessing computers in the library or through some technology commons or something like that, and ensuring that the on-campus bandwidth can support this growth of access. And perhaps last but definitely not least, developing faculty and course development services to prepare faculty to support students and to develop their own courses in these different modalities. because not only are students going to be taking them, faculty are going to have to develop and teach them. And we need to prepare them to be successful in all of these different modalities. So let me wrap up, and then we have a few minutes for questions. Going forward, meeting the needs of these different students with these different institutional ecosystems to support, encourage, and enable them are going to be really important for us to meet our strategic plans, to provide educational access, and ultimately to enable student success and completion. And if you want to know more about this and get a few more details, I think it's chapter 16 in the Game Changers book that you can get for free online through EDUCAUSE. And you're welcome to download it and read it and send me questions if you have them. So with that, let me open it up to any questions there might be in the room or online, and I'll be happy to answer them if I can. Sure. So the question is, how are we promoting or supporting credit by exam or credit by portfolio, prior learning assessment kind of stuff? And it's something that I think UCF, my current institution, will need to confront a lot more actively than we are currently confronting it. We have pathways for that, but they're not really actively being engaged right now. I will say when I was at Embry-Riddle, they were a lot more, I think, forward-thinking because they had so many military students that showed up with these military certifications. So if they were in an aviation maintenance academic program and they showed up with an aviation maintenance certification from the military, there was a way you could assess that competency and give them academic credit for that. So they had some infrastructure there to support that. But that's a huge trend in higher education in general these days, and I think that may play into it. So maybe we'll need another circle on the Venn diagram. How many students are getting credits through other means, such as prior learning? Yes, in the back.
Hi. Thanks for your talk. I think there's no question you've identified a real phenomenon in today's students. But what I'm wondering is whether or not the picture with respect to modality isn't more complex than your talk lets on. And I'm thinking about two things. I'm from the University of Minnesota. We've conducted large-scale technology surveys with our students over a number of years and asked them about their preference for different courses and different modalities. And we found a very strong preference, which has persisted over years, against the fully online format and in favor of formats that have some degree of face-to-face contact with other students and with faculty members. Now, these students are willing to take courses that are fully online for reasons of convenience and so forth, right? But that is not their preference. And the second thing is that, at least as I understand the results of the recent large meta-analyses of student learning outcomes when it comes to using technology in education, the learning outcomes produced by the fully online format, at least on average, are inferior to those of blended formats. So that seems to be two ways in which we're not really post-modality yet.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. I assume the online audience was able to hear that because of the microphone. That meta study that was conducted by SRI, Barbara Means will be speaking here on Wednesday, so feel free to ask her questions about it. We have found the same data at UCF, and we've been tracking that for 17 years. And what we found is that students do prefer blended over online and face-to-face, and they perform better in blended as opposed to online and face-to-face. So maybe if they had their druthers, they would choose more blended courses. There are limitations in being able to scale blended learning from an institutional perspective just because you still need those physical classrooms. So it hasn't grown at the rate that online learning has because there are other variables playing into the growth of online learning. Addressing the access issues and the educational demand issues, you can open a virtual online section much more easily than you can a blended section. And for some of the reasons you cited, that for convenience mostly, students do gravitate towards web-based instruction, even if the preference might be blended because of some convenience factors. But I don't disagree with anything you said. We have found the same thing, that students both prefer and perform better in blended courses. Yes?
I have some online questions.
Okay.
Alan Heaps asks, besides infrastructure, How will faculty roles adapt to this post-modality?
Well, faculty have to become post-modality-ish, too, because faculty are no longer going to be able to just teach face-to-face courses if that's all they want to do. At some point, faculty are probably going to be compelled in many institutions to teach at least some online or blended courses, even if it's just as a supplement to a program. It's not an entire online program, but maybe some courses for various reasons might need to be offered online. What we found at UCF is that even faculty hiring decisions on their willingness to teach online, depending upon the department, is a factor in whether or not they'll get hired. And I've heard anecdotally some departments that have gone to their second choice in hiring a faculty member because the first choice said that they had no interest in teaching online. And for that program, I'm thinking some of our health services professional programs, they need online learning to serve their students. So having a faculty member who's going to refuse to teach online just isn't going to fit with their strategic goals. And so I think it's a two-way street. Not only do faculty have to have a willingness to teach online and maybe engage with some of these alternate modalities, but the institution, I think, has a responsibility to prepare them to be successful, to invest in them, to invest in faculty development and in training and resources and support for the faculty as much as for the students. Is there another question online?
Yes, I've got two more. Ty Naylor. How do you maintain quality in online courses comparable to face-to-face? What are the major challenges to maintain instructional quality?
That's a whole separate PowerPoint I've got. If you've got 2 hours, I can call that one up and we can talk about it. In summary, in just a really short answer that doesn't do it justice, it's attending to online courses with the same care that you do face-to-face courses, and maybe even more care when it comes to faculty development, faculty support, assessment to determine if what you're doing is working. And in some cases, I think that the threshold of proof, the burden of proof, is even higher than it is in face-to-face because many people start with this initial skepticism. So you have to work even harder to kind of prove that online learning is as good as face-to-face learning. Assuming, you know, my colleagues in the back of the room, some of my friends from UCF, like to say that since when did face-to-face learning become the gold standard of instruction? You know, only since the introduction of online learning. So how do we know that there's quality face-to-face instruction? I don't think that's necessarily an answer. It sounds almost like you're ducking the question, but I think that's also a legitimate question. Because maybe the same methods can be used to assess whether or not your online courses are successful or high quality if you use the same methods you're using for your face-to-face. There's a lot more in that question that we can talk about, certainly.
Tracy Atkins, how do you handle testing for your online students? Is it proctored?
Again, whole other presentation. There are all of the different schools that I highlighted, they all have different strategies. And we have some courses and faculty and departments that have proctored exams, and we have some that don't or that do online proctoring. So it runs the gamut. It's whatever burden of authentication you feel you need to have for your students. We tend to prefer more authentic assessment that makes it harder to cheat. So that's one strategy, but again, that's a much richer question to get into than I think we have time to talk about right now. I think we have time for one more. Yes.
Hi. One thing I'm hearing more and more about is high flux classes. And I'm just wondering, do you allow or is there opportunity for students at UCF to take the very same class, the very same semester, you know, sometimes attend the face-to-face version, another class period attend the online, or is it just you register for online or blended or face-to-face?
How many of you are familiar with the term high flex? Do you know what that is? High flex is, for those of you who didn't raise your hand, the a blended learning format that allows the student to come and go into the face-to-face and online environments at their leisure, basically. They can pick 1 week to be face-to-face, 1 week to be online, and mix it up at their convenience. And the course just proceeds apace, regardless of who shows up or doesn't show up in the online or face-to-face environment. And we actually do have a couple of courses that operate like that. We don't code them as HyFlex or as a separate modality, but they're in our lecture capture. They're kind of large courses. And the students can come to class or watch the lectures online, and they're mostly in our College of Business. So we do have some of that, but it's more of an outlier for us to meet specific needs in the College of Business. And I'm frankly not aware of that happening at any of the other schools that I profiled in this presentation. Are any of you doing HyFlex courses at your institutions? I think there's a presentation on it in the program I think I saw, so if you're interested, you should check it out. Well, if there are no other questions, I want to thank you all for coming and asking good questions. I'll be happy to hang out if anybody wants to chat some more, and have a good conference.